This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
And it looks like the number of people flying is going to double by 2035. And of course, with the IPCC saying that we've got to cut back our carbon significantly, flying is one thing that really has to be looked at closely. And instead, it's just doubling.
The Industrial Revolution ushered in an era of more efficient transportation. As history has shown us, the impact of our ability to move easily across town and across the planet is complex. It's made the world smaller, but it's also given rise to the climate crisis. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to tree huggers Lloyd Alter about innovations in the transportation space. First, we look at one of the cleanest, oldest, and best forms of modern transport, the bicycle. We look at the latest designs in e-bikes, discuss whether or not they'll come down in price and become more ubiquitous, and examine the gender gap in cycling. Then we talk about the threat that cheap flights and booming ridership pose for the planet, and the future of self-driving cars and ride-sharing. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Lloyd Alter. He's a design editor at treehugger.com and an adjunct professor at Ryerson University School of Interior Design in Toronto, Canada. Lloyd, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
A pleasure to be here.
Good to have you back. I wanted to catch up with you on some of the pieces you've been writing for Treehugger recently that revolve around transportation. It's obviously a pretty big topic, but you find some very interesting niches to explore. Let's first dive into bikes. It's an area that you spend a lot of time researching. One article that kind of struck my eye was, to fight climate change, we need to get more women on bikes. That was something I hadn't really thought of, is the gender disparity in terms of bicycle ridership. Why don't you expand?
Well, it's quite significant, especially in cities with crappy bike infrastructure. Women are not anywhere near the majority. They ride about half as often as men do. And there are a number of reasons for this. For one thing, men can be jerks and get out there and be aggressive and push their way through situations. But women are a little more afraid of getting out there and mixing in traffic. And so in cities that have fully separated and protected bike lanes, like you see in Montreal or in Copenhagen or in Vancouver, you get a much, much higher percentage of women riding than you do in other cities. Another problem with women finding and cycling is helmets. I know it sounds sexist, but it's actually been proven true in studies that they spend a lot of time not wanting to get their hair messed up by putting a helmet in their head. So that as soon as helmets became mandatory in Australia, the rate of women riding dropped by a factor to about a quarter of what it was before. Hmm. And this has been shown all over the world. And in Copenhagen, where nobody really wears a helmet, and in the Netherlands, where nobody, period, wears a helmet, the cycling rate for women is almost 50%.
And have there been any studies that show the disparity when it comes to women and men in terms of recreational riding versus commuting?
Recreational riding, they're much closer. Recreational riding is something people do with their families and their kids, and it's significantly higher. But the real issue for me on cycling is getting people out of cars and out of crowded subways and getting exercise and getting to work. So I'm much more interested in the commuting to school and the commuting to work than I am worried, and I'm not particularly worried about the residential sector. But even there, bikes have not been well designed for women. They may drop the top bar so that it's easier to step into, but often the proportions aren't right. The seats aren't very good for women. And so, you know, people haven't really thought this through about how do you make it comfortable. When you go to, again, the Netherlands, you see everybody is sitting on upright bikes where they've got wide seats, they've got baskets in front, the sitting position is absolutely vertical. There is even this metal thing that covers about a third of the back wheel that in fact is a skirt guard so that skirts can't get caught in the wheels.
Yes, I know in Japan, part of the whole aesthetic since the late 80s has been much more what you're talking about in terms of the Dutch design, one that's more upright and a lot more comfy and more practical for shopping and getting about town.
Exactly.
Chari is kind of the nickname for carriage. It's the old Japanese word for carriage. So Mama Chari is like a mom bike, which is what you're describing in these.
Exactly.
These one that have the skirt thing. And then Yama is the Japanese word for mountain. So Yama Chari is mountain bike. It seems like the Mama Chari has not really taken off in the States, in terms of coolness factor, at least.
Well, it's beginning to. A lot of American companies are making sort of Dutch bike knockoffs. A lot of it has to do that people are finding that the bikes like city bikes are really comfortable. You know, they've got a step-through design without a top bar. They've got a comfortable vertical sitting position. And so more and more people are looking at that. Also, older people really should be getting that kind of bike as well, step through, comfortable seating. There was talk in the Copenhagen Bicycle Association that they were actually saying, you know, they should just ban top bars on bikes, that every bike should be a step through bike because people fall off because they can't get their leg fast enough. Older people have a lot of trouble getting their legs over it. The bike design was, even though it goes back to the safety bike design from 1880, it's still designed around the needs of men, and it's still generally more aggressive rather than more of a comfortable get-around-town bike design that you do see in the Netherlands.
And are there any studies that show that women ridership increases with better bike lanes and more urban planning around bicycles?
Absolutely, absolutely. Everywhere they've done it, they've shown the numbers have skyrocketed. There's studies from Vancouver, from Montreal, and of course, from places like Copenhagen. Even in New York City, as more and more bike lanes got put in, they found that the woman ridership went way up. And the other ridership that goes way up is the ridership of aging baby boomers. You know, people like me who are getting a little more nervous when they're getting out in the road, that they don't want to tangle with everybody out in the street and that take the lane and grab your position.
So let's talk about electric bikes. That's changing the elements a little bit more about how committed somebody has to be in terms of a workout. For example, I used to live on top of a very big hill in San Francisco, and just to use my bike to go get some milk meant kind of an investment in terms of, you know, I'd be sweating, and it changes your behavior if you have to actually kind of exercise fully to get around. But e-bikes are changing that. You don't necessarily have to be in terrific shape to cover a significant amount of ground with an electric-assisted bike. So people who have seen electric-assisted bikes around town will have noticed quite a range of styles.
Yes.
Why don't you kind of give us a snapshot of the market right now, and then we'll talk about some of your favorite designs.
Well, there's really been a revolution in design thanks to much better batteries, which is really a spin-off almost from the car industry. But the batteries have much greater power and holding capacity, and motors have gotten better too. And in Europe, the revolution hit first. It hit about a decade ago when Bosch started making these lovely center drives. And now half the bikes in Europe are electric because people there use their bikes a lot for commuting. And the electric bike essentially doubles or triples the distances people are willing to commute. So for instance, in the Netherlands, people used to bike to the train station and then take the train and then have to walk. And now they're finding more and more people are doing long, 10-mile commutes on bikes that they wouldn't before. The other thing is, exactly like you've found when you live in a hilly city, that they really eat up the terrain. I was in Seattle and met a guy who was running the Bullitt Center, the greenest building in North America, and they had a bike garage, but nowhere to plug it in. And he had an electric bike and said it's the only way he can bike to work. He's got seven hills to go up and down, and the electric bike makes things possible that you couldn't do it before. Like you mentioned in your introduction, electric bikes are also terrific for people who aren't as fit, and they're terrific for people who are getting older and just can't do as much and go as far and keep up. I was riding, when I was in Minnesota recently, I was riding a $5,000 cargo bike made by Surly that was the most beautiful machine I'd ever been on. And the electronics have gotten so good that it just picks up your pedaling and gives you a boost, and you decide how much it's going to give you the boost. And it's based on the European system called a pedelec, which means it doesn't have a throttle. It means you pedal and it picks up your cadence and your push and it gives you a boost. The pedelecs from the European Union are all limited to 250 watts power, 20 miles an hour top speed, and they cannot have a throttle. What's happened when e-bikes started coming to North America is that there were no rules. So people are getting bikes with 750 watts. People are getting scooters that have no pedals, that look more like Vespas. And everybody's fighting over the same bike lanes. And in New York, all the delivery people are getting arrested because their bikes have throttles. And it's insane. Whereas what we need in North America is a standard like they have in Europe. And I think it should be the same standard. Everybody says, oh, 250 watts isn't enough. But 250 watts was on that amazing e-bike, that $5,000 e-bike, and it was more than enough.
In terms of range, what does 250 watts mean?
Well, the 250 watts is the power. The range is a function of the size of the battery.
Got it.
And they're now, 40, 60. On that bike, you could put on two batteries and you could get 100 miles out of it.
And you can also bring one with you, like in a bag, and swap them out sometimes on certain models, right?
Yes, absolutely, on certain of them. I'm testing an electric bike right now that's at the other end of the scale. It's a $500 Chinese electric bike, and I look at it, and it's not the same thing, but obviously it's 10% the price, and I've been using it commuting around Toronto, and the throttle isn't as smooth. When you pedal, it doesn't quite pick it up as easily. It seems to have just three speeds, depending on whatever you do with your pedaling. But it eats up the terrain. It makes it much easier. Toronto, where I live, is all built in a slight tilt down to the lake. So when I go down to teach, it's easy to get there. Then you spend the day and you're tired and your whole way back home is up a gradual slope. Well, this thing just made it a breeze. And I can really see how they could get a lot of people out of cars, particularly in busy cities like New York and Toronto and San Francisco or Seattle, where parking gets really expensive and congestion is really terrible.
If a man of moral character bows his head to pray, who can he betray? Will he come back or won't he? Won't he? Will he come back or won't he?
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Lloyd Alter. He's design editor at Tree Hugger. What do you see as some of the ways to kind of overcome the price barriers in terms of becoming more ubiquitous? Is it going to be rentals or e-bikes that come down in price from these $5,000 price tags? Because that's, you could buy a car for $5,000.
Yes, I have. But like I'm saying, right now I'm riding a $500 bike that this e-bike is worth less than my non-e-bike, costs less, and it's adequate for commuting. I don't know what happens once a Chinese bike that they sent over, especially for me, starts falling apart. But right now it's a very nice little bit of gear, and it's folding, so you can take it inside and carry it up. The issue of ownership versus rental, it's, I think, very much the same as it is with conventional bikes. They're not always where you want them to be. I've been in New York where there isn't a bike to pick up when I want to pick it up. Then when I've got a bike, there's nowhere to put it when I'm finished with it. The whole dockless bike share thing was a complete disaster almost anywhere where it's been tried, because people would just leave the bikes anywhere and everywhere.
Kind of like the problem with e-scooters, right, in a lot of cities.
Well, yeah, you know, of course, as we like to joke also, every time we see cars parked in the bike lane or on the side dock, we call them dockless cars, that people are just, people are jerks in every mode of transportation, it seems.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought of it. Dockless cars are pretty much cars.
Yes. So I really think that this, you know, we also, again, with an aging population, we've got to get people out into healthier modes of transportation. Just get their legs turning, get them moving, get out in the fresh air. It's critical. And I've seen, when I've been in Scandinavia, really old people on their bikes and on their e-bikes, it really extends them. Their lives on them. There was a study originally that said senior citizens in the Netherlands and in Copenhagen were dying at a much faster rate from riding e-bikes than riding regular bikes, and they were worried that they were more dangerous. But then they looked at the study again, and they found that old people who fall die at a much faster rate, whether they're walking, cycling, e-biking, or anything. That's just the nature of old bones. So that the study really discounted the question of whether e-bikes were more dangerous. I think in North America, where there are so few limits on what you can buy, and people think, oh, I want more power, because that's what they always did when they bought cars, that everybody's buying the wrong thing. And you've got to keep it simple, keep it low-powered, have it so that it gives you a boost, not that you're getting on some kind of electric motorcycle. It should be a bike with a boost, is what I call it.
So let's move to some other transportation issues beyond the bicycle. You wrote a piece earlier in April entitled, Is Flying Dying? No, it's growing faster than ever. Is this a dire thing for environmentalists, or are there some silver linings behind this?
Well, it's very dire. The phrase "is flying dying" was first said by the English environmental writer George Monbiot in 2006. And he was saying that there was sort of a cognitive dissonance, that friends of his would recycle everything, not eat meat, and then every weekend they'd go get in a plane and fly off to Rome or somewhere, which you can do from the UK so cheaply with all those EasyJet flights, and that more and more people are flying all the time, even though right now it's responsible for about 8% of worldwide carbon emissions, and they're really seriously dangerous emissions because they're up in the stratosphere, so that the effects, the forcing effects, as they call it, are far worse than it would be if you were down on the ground. And of course, these discount airlines are just so many of them, particularly in Europe, are proliferating, even though they've got a fabulous rail system. I was doing a lecture in Lisbon a few months ago, and I flew to London first to visit my sister. Then I spent about $30 to fly from London to Portugal. And then I had to take a train for an hour to get to where I was speaking. And that train for an hour cost $40. I mean, right now, long distance flying is cheaper than short distance train travel or bus. It's crazy.
I just had lunch with a friend of mine who lives in Belgium, who was saying that these low cost airlines are really proliferating, mainly because of cost. People take buses or fly, but they've been eschewing the high-speed rail system in Europe, which Americans look at jealously because it is very efficient and a terrific way to get around, but it's expensive and you need reservations generally. And he was saying, if you're going to go through all of that hassle, you may as well fly. And it's sometimes cheaper to fly than to take the high-speed rail. And it's much, much cheaper to take a bus. Like, he could take a bus for like $15 from Belgium to London or Paris versus, you know, over $100 on a high-speed rail.
Yeah, flying is far cheaper now than the high-speed rail, and it's absolutely crazy. And I keep looking at it and wonder, how do they make money? Now, when you look at what's happening in North America, the planes are getting more efficient. The Boeing 787 is about 20% less fuel per passenger. The whole MAX 8 that was just grounded, the whole point of that plane was that it was going to be significantly more fuel efficient than the 737 that it was being an upgrade from. So this was all about fuel efficiency. And they are getting better, but they're then dropping the prices and flying more people and getting more planes. And it looks like the number of people flying is going to double by 2035. And of course, with the IPCC saying that we've got to cut back our carbon significantly, flying is one thing that really has to be looked at closely. And instead, it's just doubling. So this is my biggest moral quandary. It is my single biggest carbon sin, is that I love it when I'm invited to lecture somewhere. I love it when I go traveling. It would be such a great loss to not be able to do what I'm doing this June and going and touring all the buildings designed by Le Corbusier on a Le Corbusier tour. I mean, to say, oh, I can't do that because of my carbon footprint is so hard. But we're going to have to do something.
Yes. And from a policy standpoint, it harkens back for me to the discussion we have about electric grids in countries like the U.S. versus developing countries in Africa, where we say, all right, you can't now kind of enjoy the last 50 to 100 years of electricity on demand, and you can't really be part of the modern age. And similarly to people now who can suddenly afford to fly. It used to be something 30, 40 years ago, most lower income people didn't have a chance to ever get on an airplane. And now we're seeing that change. And that is unfortunately a bad thing for the planet, but it's a good thing in terms of opening up minds across a wide spectrum of socioeconomic levels.
Absolutely. I mean, the great bulk of the growth is people from India and China, where the middle class is growing hugely and quickly, and they want to do all the things that middle class people do and enjoy the fruits of life and see the world. So this is the quandary. We've got to... There's a lot of talk that electric planes are getting closer and closer to being practical, but they'll really only be good for short-range trips. They won't be able to go transatlantic for quite a while, and that will be a big improvement. But right now, it's again, like I say, it's my serious moral quandary. Is this something I should be doing, or should I just be saying, oh, let me just send you a video conference of my lecture? Send you a video of it. I did that to Portugal 2 years ago, and they liked my lecture so much they asked me back. And I can tell you, doing it in person was infinitely more satisfying and enriching than sort of sending them a Skype video.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Lloyd Alter. He's design editor at Tree Hugger. Let's go beyond the bumps in the road in the early stages, and let's kind of look a few years forward to the idea of self-driving cars possibly replacing the chauffeured vehicles that we're driving in, the Lyfts, the Ubers. Are those going to significantly impact public transit? You wrote a piece on how a lot of cities are delaying transit investment because they're kind of in wait-and-see mode here.
Well, yes, there's three things that are happening with self-driving cars. If you look in New York City and a couple of other cities that let Uber and Lyft in and went wild, the transit utilization has actually gone down. They are actually sucking people away from the transit system because, well, you don't have to climb down all those stairs. You don't need to crowd with all these other people. And because Uber is losing money on every ride, it's actually not that expensive. Uber, even in their recent offering that they just put out this week, admitted that they're having an impact on public transit. The original, when they started talking about self-driving cars about 5 years ago seriously, they said, our cities will be much clearer and there will be fewer cars because currently cars are parked 95% of the time. So with self-driving cars, we'll just share them. So that'll mean, you know, there will be like 80% fewer cars on the road. And our roads will be clear and all the parking spaces will disappear because all of the cars are just going around to pick up somebody else, etc., etc. In fact, it's just like people have home theater systems, even though they can get a much better experience by going out to the theater and watching it on the bigger screen, even though their home theaters are only used like for 1 hour a night or whatever, when they could be sharing the theatrical experience. And it's the same with cars. People like their car. People like their privacy. They like their glass in the drink holder. And what's going to happen is that we're going to see a lot more of them. You know, if you want to run in and pick up your dry cleaning and you can't park with a self-driving car, you'll just tell it to go around the block. In fact, people may do all their shopping and just tell the cars to go around the block. Or if you tell it to go home, that means there's a car doing two trips instead of one trip right at that time.
But of course, these are all going to be hopefully electric vehicles, right?
Yes, but that doesn't change the geometry, the fact that you've got so many vehicles, probably more vehicles doing more miles than we have now on what are very, very crowded roads. Now, they'll drive better because they'll know when the car in front of it starts moving, so there's not going to be that gap that time. They'll actually, the roads will carry more cars more efficiently when they're all self-driving cars, and there won't be traffic lights like they are now. They'll just sort of, if you can imagine, just flow through each other at intersections because they know where every car is and they can do that. But they won't coexist very well with people. Unless they design the self-driving cars to willingly kill pedestrians, they're going to essentially, every time a pedestrian stops out in front of them, they're going to have to stop. And they even found this in some of the trials, that pedestrians would just do this for fun. When they'd see a self-driving car coming, they'd go step in front of it. So what you're going to have is you're going to have all kinds of rules coming in. You're going to have fences put up on the side of every road like you often see in London. Or if you've been to Hong Kong, we're going to have vertical separations to keep pedestrians all off the roads. Because in cities, they're just not going to coexist very well with people at all. And, you know, traffic lights. They don't need traffic lights, like I said, but people do. So we're going to start getting those stupid tunnels and bridges. And it's just not going to be very nice for cars and people to coexist.
Lloyd Alter, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
Thanks a lot.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Ernest Ranglin and Alex Wise.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For SeaChange Radio, I'm Alex Wise.